Good morning, this is AM. I'm Michael Brissenden. The corruption scandal engulfing soccer's world governing body FIFA has arrived in Germany. Prosecutors have raided the headquarters of the country's soccer association over allegations that Germany paid bribes to secure votes to host the 2006 World Cup. Authorities in several countries are now investigating allegations of corruption within FIFA, and the organisation's president, Sepp Blatter, has been suspended. Europe correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
Russia 2018, Qatar 2022, South Africa 2010, and now Germany 2006. Four soccer World Cups now subject to investigations of corruption and wrongdoing. Last month, Germany's Der Spiegel magazine alleged that a slush fund was set up to buy the votes which saw Germany awarded the 2006 tournament. That money, $10.2 million, was then transferred to FIFA in 2005, the magazine alleged. Now, prosecutors in Frankfurt have acted, sending in 50 police officers to raid the offices of the German Soccer Association, as well as the homes of several senior and former figures in the association. State prosecutor Nadja Niesen.
The investigations are directed towards the German Football Association president, also against the incumbent president in 2006 and the former general secretary. Documents have already been secured, written documents and documents in electronic form. What will come out of further examination has yet to be seen.
Prosecutors say they're investigating a serious case of tax evasion in relation to the 2005 payment. Allegations of bribery and corruption can no longer be pursued because of the statute of limitations. The former president of the Soccer Association, Theo Zwanziger, says he has nothing to fear.
I have no worries. Do you know how many prosecutions I have already seen? I am totally relaxed. I actually expected them to show up earlier.
Damian Collins is a British MP who campaigns for reform of FIFA.
I think the fact that they've now been drawn into the investigations in the way that they have just shows, I think, that this is a much broader investigation into wrongdoing over many countries and involving many different people. I think we can see this is rapidly becoming a much bigger issue than just, you know, Sepp Blatter and Jack Warner. It's going to involve a lot more people along the way.
What did you make of Franz Beckenbauer, the former German captain's statement that mistakes had been made in the bidding process, but his denial that bribery and vote buying had taken place?
Well, if it wasn't for these recent actions and allegations, then I don't believe he would have commented upon this at all. And I think it looks like he's reluctantly commenting after the fact. But I think he really should lay out everything he knows and be prepared to cooperate fully with the authorities in their investigations.
The German Soccer Association denies any wrongdoing. This is Barbara Miller reporting for AM.
First it was smoke from peat fires, now it's volcanic ash that's causing chaos in Indonesia. Indonesia last night closed two major airports in Bali and Lombok because of ash blowing from an erupting volcano. Virgin and Jetstar had already cancelled all flights in and out of Bali's Denpasar Airport, and the volcano that's causing all the trouble is becoming more active every day. Flight cancellations and airport closures disrupted the tourism industry in Bali for several weeks earlier this year. Indonesia correspondent Adam Harvey reports.
Lombok's Mount Barujari has been erupting for 1 week, and it's getting louder by the day. Mutahalan is a volcanologist based at the nearby Mount Rinjani observation post. He's been monitoring the area's volcanoes for more than 20 years. And he's got some bad news for those hoping this volcano will quieten soon. Based on my experience of watching this mountain, the explosions will never happen just for a couple of weeks. In 2009, it happened for 1.5 years. The volcanic ash cloud is about 1 kilometre high and blowing northwest from Lombok towards Bali. That prompted Virgin and Jetstar to cancel their flights in and out of Denpasar, as ash can affect aircraft engines. Last night, the Indonesian Transport Ministry announced that it would close airports in Bali and Lombok until further notice, on advice from the Volcanic Ash Advisory Centre. Mount Barujari erupts approximately every 5 years, the last time in 2009. A mudslide from a 1994 eruption killed more than 30 villages. Compared to the 1994 eruption, which cost lots of lives, this eruption is considered far smaller. At that time, the volcanic ash column climbed 7,000 metres high and blew as far as East Java. Right now, the ash is thin and only affects aviation if it reaches 2,000 metres. If the ash gets blown higher by a strong vertical wind, then it can cause more trouble.
The ash may yet affect even more flights. Indonesian authorities are also monitoring conditions around the nearby East Java airport. This is Adam Harvey reporting for AM from Jakarta.
And you're listening to AM around Australia, where it's 16 minutes past 7. A five-year study of Australians' views on climate change has found 78% people believe it is happening, but there's a surprising level of volatility in personal views. The CSIRO study found only 28% of Liberal voters believe human activity is responsible for climate change, compared to 58% of Labor voters. But one of the report's authors, Zoe Leveston, says many respondents changed their opinion over different surveys. Dr. Leveston spoke to Francis Keeney in Canberra.
What we find actually is that on an aggregate level, if we look at people's opinions on basic climate change attitudes, like what causes climate change, we see there's very little shift. We were unable to pick up or detect any large shifts at a national level. But if we look at more of an individual level, we can track the people who completed the surveys again and again over the 5 year or the 4 year period, and we find quite a lot of fluctuation in people's opinions. And I think what this suggests to us is that actually a lot of people talk about people's beliefs about climate change. We wouldn't expect to see that sort of volatility in individual responses if they were deep-seated beliefs. So to me, it suggests that people's attitudes towards climate change are more opinions that are responsive to changes in the social environment and also possibly the physical environment, and that fluctuation reflects quite subtle changes in an individual level environment.
What are some of the demographic instances here, gender lines or location, for instance?
Well, if we're looking at what people's opinions are about the causes of climate change, for instance, which is an attitude people seem to be very interested in, we don't find demographic differences that are very exciting, to be honest. We do find tiny differences. For instance, women on average tend to be more of the opinion that climate change is driven by human activity. But really, those differences are really small. They're not particularly meaningful. And they're certainly not meaningful when compared to, say, the influence of people's worldviews about human-nature relationships. You know, that's much more overriding as an explanatory variable. So it was quite interesting to see that things like income, age, gender really didn't have a noticeable impact on both what people thought about climate change and what they were doing in response to climate change.
What about people's political leanings?
Again, if you look at it in isolation, you can see that there are patterns between people's political orientation, even patterns in who people vote for and how they respond to climate change. But if you look at things like deep-seated worldviews, again, that human nature interaction, that accounts for that variability we see in those more surface order things like political orientation. So again, those connections or those relationships we see are explained by quite deep fundamental orientations towards the environment and humans in general. You know, I think it's an oversimplification to say it's driven by political leanings.
Dr. Zoe Leveston from the CSIRO speaking to Francis Keeney. The second round of funds available under the government's direct action scheme goes under the hammer today. The online auction will see companies competing to place the lowest bid for payment to do projects that will reduce Australia's greenhouse gas emissions. But even with the success of the first auction earlier this year, some have expressed concern about the secrecy surrounding a process that uses billions of dollars of taxpayer funds. Sarah Phillips reports.
529 projects have registered for the second reverse auction that will distribute the government's Emissions Reduction Fund, the centrepiece of its direct action climate policy. The first auction, in April, awarded 43 companies $660 million to undertake projects to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Hugh Grossman, Executive Director of Energy and Carbon Markets for market analyst firm Reputex, says this round could see an even bigger spend.
Our estimates are showing that the government could even spend up to $1 billion on the second auction.
But he has concerns.
The way the ERS has been structured is very much to create an opaque sort of market setting where, as you say, it's sort of a secret tender process. There's no transparent market price.
Grossman says that a more open auction system would give companies more certainty and deliver better value for money for taxpayers.
If you're a company, particularly a high-emitting company, you're looking at creating abatement over the long term, and that's just not next year, but that's over the next 10 or 15 years even. So I think transparency over a market price and the ability to predict what that price will be in 5 or 10 years is certainly healthy.
Ian McGill is the director of the University of New South Wales Centre for Energy and Environmental Markets. He shares Hugh Grossman's concerns.
It's very problematic with the ERF in that its transparency really is very low. That means, is it working or not? Hard to say. And that's a real problem.
He says taxpayers could wind up footing the bill for projects that a company was going to do anyway, a challenge known as additionality.
If we look at similar sorts of mechanisms that have been implemented elsewhere in the world, and one is the Clean Development Mechanism under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, they have often had additionality tests around financial additionality, really trying to make a very strong case that the funds, taxpayers' funds, are actually going to fund things that wouldn't happen otherwise, rather than just representing a nice windfall for a company that's doing something it was probably going to do anyway.
Why does it matter if we pay a company to do emissions reductions that they were going to do anyway? Doesn't it still reduce Australia's emissions, which is, after all, the point of the emissions reduction fund?
Yeah, well, I guess you could ask a taxpayer that and ask them if they're comfortable providing additional funds to people for doing things they were going to do anyway.
Chloe Munro, chair of the Clean Energy Regulator, which manages the auction, says the so-called lack of transparency helps companies stay focused.
The purpose of having sealed bids is simply that it is a single round, and what we want the bidders to do is focus on bidding at their best price, and in this context it's the lowest price at which it would be worth their while to do the project. So the design makes them focus on their best price rather than focus on outbidding the other competitors.
The successful projects will be revealed on the 12th of November, with the average price paid for the contracts also made public at that time.
Sarah Phillips reporting, and a spokesman for Environment Minister Greg Hunt says the auction process is verified by an expert panel and independently audited to ensure that the purchased abatement is achieved. He says the United Nations has strongly endorsed Australia's carbon accounting standards. Attracting and retaining doctors in the bush is an ongoing struggle, but the founders of a program to set up to help keep doctors in regional areas believe they've found a solution. The Queensland Rural Generalist Pathway gives doctors training across a broad range of fields and has seen a dramatic boost in retention rates. Lindy Kerrin reports.
Dr. Matt Van Gent is getting ready for surgery.
He's done well by lots of things for the rest of it.
He moved to Roma in regional Queensland 3 years ago.
So Roma was a town we picked out of basically all the towns in Queensland, and we really liked the town.
Dr. Van Gent says he enjoys the challenges of working in a regional area.
I'm doing anaesthesia today, and one of our other rural generalists, Liam's also doing some surgery today, endoscopy. Plenty of emergency work here, and we're a hub hospital for a lot of the smaller hospitals around the southwest, so we get patients transferred here that are a little bit tricky for them, which is good.
It's that diversity that's at the heart of a program set up by two country doctors 10 years ago, at a time of desperate shortages of doctors in the bush.
Back then it was really, there was a dearth of rural hospital positions that were, people were leaving them really almost like an exodus.
Dr. Dan Manahan has a long history in regional areas and currently lives and works in Stanthorpe.
For those of us who found our way rural, we actually knew that they were the best jobs on the planet. Great variety, great engagement within communities. But for others, especially on the other side of the Great Divide, going over the Great Divide to go rural where you have less specialist colleagues, less access to pathology and radiology. In the past, that was a real concern for many people. And I think there was almost a fear or phobia for going rural in some circles.
The Queensland Rural Generalist Pathway Program offers training across various fields in a doctor's early years.
So we try and build in some rural workshopping with senior rural colleagues. And we try and build in some experiences in paediatrics, anaesthetics and obstetrics that we think are really important in rural practice.
When the program was set up, Queensland had the lowest retention rates of rural doctors in Australia. It now has the highest. And the intake of interns has increased from 20 to 77 next year. Dr. Matt Van Gent says the level of responsibility can be stressful, but he says being able to follow patients through different areas of medicine is rewarding.
Notably, if you're seeing patients in a general practice, in a community care setting, and then you're also seeing them in the emergency department, and you already know them and you know their story, that's fantastic. I had one patient who I did some stress testing on, who I'd actually referred for the stress testing, and then had some positive changes that we picked up on that test, and then, you know, went and got a pacemaker. And so, you know, you don't have that opportunity in other places to follow a patient all the way through from the community care to the acute care. So that's, yeah, it's great.
That's Dr. Matt Van Gent from Roma in Queensland speaking to Lindy Kerin. In less than 24 hours, Michelle Payne has gone from a little-known jockey to a history-making pioneer for women in sport. Her story has enraptured Australians right across the country after she beat a field of international stars to win yesterday's Melbourne Cup on a horse that was a rank outsider. The 30-year-old isn't shying away from the limelight, saying she hopes to use her newfound prominence to promote women in racing. But it hasn't been an easy journey to success. Jessica Longbottom spoke with her as she celebrated her big win last night.
At the quiet end of a Melbourne street, a hastily arranged party is in full swing. The trainer of Melbourne Cup-winning horse Prince of Penzance, Darren Weir, didn't expect to be attending a victory celebration.
These people that own the pub come from a place called Colgara. I play football for Berry Colgara and live in a place called Berrawillick, so great to come back in here and enjoy the moment.
There's about 200 people crammed into this tiny pub in South Melbourne. Everybody is having a very good time. There's many drinks. I'm seeing a few high fives and generally a lot of happy people.
Then the guest of honour arrives.
I'm just so excited. I don't really feel like I need to have a drink to be happy on over the moon.
Jockey Michelle Payne is the youngest of 10 siblings, all of whom have forged careers in horse racing. Her mother died in a car accident when she was 6 months old, leaving her father, horse trainer Paddy Payne, to raise the children.
I think Michelle's coming home tonight. She said she was coming home, but whether she gets here or not, I don't know. She might get held up party or something. Who knows?
He watched his youngest daughter make history from his home in Ballarat in central Victoria.
She had some nasty falls and we tried to tell her to give it away, but she kept going and she'd been well rewarded for doing it.
In 2004, Michelle Payne fractured her skull and bruised her brain after a fall in a race. 3 years later, her sister Bridget was killed after a fall at training.
We've had some good success and some bad luck as well. We're a close family and we get on good and my kids get on good and it's lovely for me to see that.
Paddy's son and Michelle's brother, horse trainer Patrick Payne, who's also ridden in a Melbourne Cup, says he's proud of his little sister.
Oh, really proud. You know, the old man, you know, he'd be beside himself. You know, it's a shame that, you know, Mum passed away. We would have loved watching the race together, but anyway, that's life. But I am, like, you know, she, as I said, she's done it all herself. We've criticised her all her life and, you know, told her to give her away at one stage, but she was very defiant and she said she loves doing it, so she's proved us all wrong, so good on her.
My dad's so funny. He always likes to keep everything level and he was just saying that, you know, he'd had good runs leading up and he always stays pretty calm, so that's typical dad and that's why... I think he's helped my career because he does keep you level.
Sharing in the limelight of Michelle's win has been her brother Stevie. He has Down syndrome and works as a strapper at trainer Darren Weir's stables, close to the Payne family home.
Stevie is just a blessing to our family and my dad said when he was born everyone was like, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Dad just can't get over people saying that because he is a blessing to our family. He's so happy all the time, has not got one bad bone in his body. And yeah, it's just so nice to be able to share this experience with him.
She is also grateful to Darren Weir for giving her a go. After telling chauvinists in the sport to get stuffed live on television after her Melbourne Cup win, Michelle Payne now wants to get more women to ride in prominent races.
I really want to be a great ambassador for the sport and for female jockeys and for jockeys in general.
Michelle Payne is back in the saddle again this afternoon, competing in a more modest race, the $100,000 Kyneton Cup in central Victoria.
Jessica Longbottom reporting. On the markets, the Australian dollar is buying 71.9 US cents, 65 euro cents, 46 UK pence and 87 Japanese yen. That's AM for today. I'm Michael Brissenden. It's 7:30.